Listener discretion is advised. This episode features discussions of murder, sexual violence, gore, medical procedures, and mutilations. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. When a murder goes unsolved for a year, finding the killer becomes nearly impossible. With no meaningful leads, an active case becomes cold, and resources move to more promising investigations. But just because law enforcement stops pursuing answers doesn't mean the rest of the world does. In fact, some criminal mysteries never fade from public consciousness, like that of Jack the Ripper, whose slayings took place in London in the fall of 1888. Across the next century, the gruesome attacks maintained intrigue and spawned new theories. To this day, the unsolved crime invites us to find our own answers. And now, that kind of sleuthing might actually just get somewhere, thanks to medical and scientific advancement. Because while Jack's victims may be long dead, not all their belongings were lost to time. The answer to the century and a half old puzzle might just be living in the molecules of a single shawl. This is Medical Murders, a Spotify original from Parcast. For decades, thousands of medical students have taken the Hippocratic Oath. It boils down to do no harm. But a closer look reveals a phrase much more interesting. I must not play at God. However, some doctors break that oath, choosing to play God with their patients, deciding who lives and who dies. Each week on Medical Murders, we'll investigate those who decided to kill. We'll explore the specifics of how they operate, not just on their patients, but within their own minds, examining the psychology and neurology behind heartless medical killers. I'm Alastair Murden, and I'm joined by Dr. David Kipper, MD.
Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Kipper, and I'm here to provide Alistair with some medical insight into our concluding episode of a murderous spree that has defied closure for over 150 years. Who was Jack the Ripper? What drove this killer to behave the way he or she did? And will we ever be able to solve the longest manhunt in history?
You can find episodes of Medical Murders and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. Just open the app and type Medical Murders in the search bar. This is our final episode on Jack the Ripper, mystery culprit who took at least five lives in the fall of 1888 with a precision that many call clinical. Last time, we examined the Ripper's uncanny crime scenes in Whitechapel, London. This time, we'll track theories from 1888 to present day, evaluating leads in the case that suggest history's most famous serial killer might just be a doctor. All this and more coming up. Stay with us.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
In the fall of 1888, London's Whitechapel neighborhood stood on edge. Since the previous spring, six women had turned up dead. Four had been tied to the same killer with a fair amount of confidence. But since police didn't know yet who the culprit was, locals referred to him with three nicknames: the Whitechapel Murderer, Leather Apron, and the designation he'd given himself, Jack the Ripper. As suspension echoed through the streets, investigators pored over a string of recent letters they'd received, all signed with that last moniker. If the messages were the real deal, the murderer would strike again soon. In the streets of Whitechapel, it felt like no one was safe. Sure enough, on November 9th, 1888, over a month after Jack's last hit, a woman was found dead. Only this victim, Mary Jane Kelly, wasn't splayed in the street like those before her. She was at home, a tiny, cheap rental in a Whitechapel tenement. She died in her bed. Given that Mary Jane was a sex worker, it's possible Jack bought his way into her bedroom. We can't say for sure that's how, but we do have a pretty clear picture as to why. The intimate quarters offered Jack a privacy he hadn't had before. So when he killed Mary Jane, he mutilated her body more severely than any other victim. By the time her corpse was found, her nose and ears had been removed. Her organs were arranged in a macabre circle around her body. Her head lay on a makeshift pillow of her uterus, kidney, and one breast. Her other breast and her liver were at her feet. Her spleen, intestines, and flesh from her thighs and abdomen were spread around her bed and nearby tables. And her heart was missing. Some of those mutilations were repeats of the Ripper's earlier victims, like the removal of Kate Edo's kidney and uterus. But much of the tableau was brand new to the Whitechapel killer. One investigator noted it would have taken the Ripper almost 2 hours to arrange the scene.
Like with other victims, the state of Mary Jane's corpse might offer clues about Jack's understanding of the human body. The fact that these body parts and organs were intact and recognizable could indicate that the killer had a decent grasp on anatomy and possibly surgery. Given how much was dissected and removed from her body, it's remarkable that Mary could even be propped up or positioned at all. Cutting the various bodily structures out and off would take a very long time in and of itself, because there'd need to be some procedural order. Not to mention a lot of meticulous and tough cutting through things like connective tissue, ligaments, tendons, and fat. Out of every mutilation here, it seems to me that cohesively removing the intestines would be the most difficult surgical maneuver, because you're dealing with a deep, delicate, 30-foot-long organ that spools and folds onto itself. A crime scene like this implies a disturbingly distinct familiarity and skill set, so it's understandable that investigators kept concluding the Ripper had medical know-how.
But from the crime scene alone, Scotland Yard still didn't know where to look for suspects. London was full of medical professionals. Luckily, 3 days after Mary Jane's body was discovered, on November 12, 1888, a lead came in. A man named George Hutchinson told police that he saw Mary Jane before her murder, and she hadn't been alone. According to George, on the evening of the homicide, Mary Jane approached him on the street, begging for sixpence. George didn't have the cash to spare, and Mary Jane walked away. Not long after, George saw a man tap Mary Jane on the shoulder. He said something George couldn't make out. Whatever it was made Mary Jane laugh. As the two walked away together, George noticed how the man pushed his hat down over his face. Finding it strange, he tailed the couple for several minutes, until they slipped away. Now, George wasn't a police officer. He was an ordinary labourer. But he'd almost certainly heard the news reports about the Ripper murders. So he might have worried for Mary Jane, because for the next 45 minutes, George lingered on the street, searching for the pair. He didn't see them again. The next day, all George's worst fears were confirmed. Mary Jane was murdered. The man who approached her had to be Jack the Ripper. That would explain his hiding behind his cap. He hadn't wanted to be seen. But George had spotted him. Eager to provide details for authorities, George reported that the murderer was in his mid-30s, about 5'6" with a moustache. His outfit was surly, but respectable. This was consistent with observations made by earlier eyewitnesses. Heartened, law enforcement dispatched more officers to patrol Whitechapel in search of men who matched that description. They also extended a blanket pardon for anyone other than the actual murderer who came forward with information. But nobody claimed the generous offer. Public outrage grew each day that passed without an arrest. When the Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police resigned for reasons unrelated to the Whitechapel murders, he was lambasted in the press for his incompetence. One evening, vigilantes attacked an innocent Londoner on a late evening stroll, baselessly believing him to be the Ripper. It seemed paranoia had gotten the better of Whitechapel citizens. Mad with suspicion, they'd lost sight of who they were truly searching for, which may have granted the real culprit a chance to slip away unnoticed. After Mary Jane Kelly's death, it appeared the Ripper stopped, though a few later deaths seemed like they could be related. In December 1888, a woman was found dead in the street. Her injuries suggested she'd been strangled, but medical examiners initially questioned whether her death was a murder or an accident.
Certain details can clue in medical examiners if a person was killed intentionally. Strangulation can be a tough one if you're only looking at someone's neck, because at that point you're trying to decide what could have been used to squeeze or constrict airflow, which doesn't always help in deciphering motivation. Victims who've been intentionally murdered by strangulation do often present with some notable signs, however. For example, they may have cuts on their hands, blood or flesh under their fingernails, and other bruises or wounds on their bodies. These clues could indicate that a victim was fighting back or that the killing was incited by a physical altercation. These are pretty clear indicators of foul play, but unfortunately, they don't necessarily advance an investigation.
Without much to go on, investigators couldn't link this woman to Jack the Ripper. The same problem occurred the following year, in 1889, when another sex worker's body was found in the road. Her throat was slit, her stomach slashed. Though the attacker may have drawn some inspiration from Jack's killings, the coroners found that the wounds weren't as deep, and the attacker was less confident with their knife. Police disagreed. Papers stoked fears throughout London, reporting the return of the Ripper. But the murderer's time of terror was running out. In February 1891, a constable found a woman's body in the street. Again, the victim had a lethal cut to the throat. This time, detectives quickly identified a top suspect in the case, a married man who'd been having an affair with her. Oddly, he bore a resemblance to earlier descriptions of Jack the Ripper. But the only hard evidence authorities had against him was the fact that he'd been with the victim the night she died. It wasn't enough to convict him of the single slaying, let alone the five canonical Whitechapel murders. And Jack the Ripper's identity remained a mystery. Officers would simply have to wait for him to strike again and hope to find a stronger lead. But they couldn't. Because at some point in the late 1880s or early 1890s, Jack the Ripper stopped taking lives for reasons we don't understand. And when he vanished, he left the entire world looking for him. Coming up, the doctors who may have been Jack the Ripper.
You tell yourself it's only a movie. None of this could ever happen to you.
You feel relieved until you discover what you're watching is based on actual events.
Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa and Greg from the Spotify original from Parcast, Serial Killers. In our Halloween special, Real Horror, we're spotlighting three of the most iconic horror films of all time and telling the terrifying true stories that inspired them.
Recovering the real influences behind characters like Ghostface from the 90s mega-hit Scream, Hannibal Lecter and Buffalo Bill from the Oscar-winning thriller The Silence of the Lambs, and Leatherface from the 70s cult classic The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Enjoy Real Horror, the Serial Killers three-part Halloween special. Listen to all three episodes the final week of October, free and only on Spotify.
Now, back to the story. On November 9th, 1888, Jack the Ripper killed his final canonical victim. Nobody knows for sure if Mary Jane Kelly had technically been his last mark. Still, the links connecting him to the three deaths that followed hers were weak at best. And as Jack's reign of terror faded to a distant memory, the neighborhood of Whitechapel, England, released a collective sigh. Still, curiosity lingered. Unfortunately, as folks tried to connect the dots, the clues read more like muddled tea leaves than cold, hard fact. Police had badly mishandled the Ripper investigation. A lot of the evidence was permanently lost or tampered with, preventing appropriate reassessment. For instance, the first victim, Polly Nichols, was washed before her post-mortem examination, and her blood was swept off the street before anyone could investigate the spatter. Likewise, Annie Chapman's clothes were removed and her body washed before the medical examiner had a chance to check for clues. It's impossible to say why authorities had been so sloppy. They may have deemed the deaths unimportant at first, since the victims were assumed to be sex workers. Nevertheless, the unexplained murders attracted a new kind of sleuth. Men with time to waste, who were undaunted by subpar evidence. One of the first to theorize on Jack the Ripper's identity was a South London-based clerk named Edward Knight Larkins. In the late 1880s, Larkins wrote letters to law enforcement with his theories. Larkins claimed the deaths lined up with times when livestock transport ships docked in London, so he thought the killer was involved in the shipping or cattle industry. The Ripper would come into town for a night, commit heinous crimes, and ship back out. By the time anyone looked for him, he'd be out of Whitechapel, out of London, and out to sea. There was just one problem. While animals were moved in and out of the city on the days the Ripper struck, it wasn't the same boat each time. Larkins argued that the killer seaman must have transferred to a new ship at least twice so he could keep returning. Officials were skeptical, especially after they found no records of sailors changing ships that matched Larkins' timeline. Yet other theories seemed even more unlikely. In the aftermath of the fall 1888 killings, also termed the Autumn of Terror, many Londoners filed false allegations against their enemies and exes. All too often, people accused others of being the Ripper to settle scores, wasting valuable police resources. But something else happened too. As widespread gossip granted Jack the Ripper celebrity status, he suddenly became the subject of literature. The first non-fiction booklets about Jack the Ripper were published in late 1888, the same year as the killings. By the next year, novels offered fictional solutions to the case, while Canadian, Italian, and Danish writers offered their own theories around the turn of the century. And the storytelling didn't end there. The dawn of the film industry meant Jack the Ripper and fictional killers based on him became stars of the silver screen. TV adaptations followed, and while all of these portrayals were made up, they did eventually prompt new theories about the killer's real identity. In the 1970s, Criminologist magazine identified a possible culprit in Dr. Thomas Neil Cream. If that name sounds familiar, it could be because we covered him on this show before. Dr. Cream was a Scottish-born surgeon who spent most of his life in Canada and the United States. After his first wife died under suspicious circumstances, he spent a few years in London before returning to Ontario to perform illegal abortions. Given his professional familiarity with the female reproductive system, Dr. Cream probably had enough anatomical knowledge to precisely remove uteruses, just as the Ripper had.
That could be, but even trained doctors in the 19th century weren't necessarily as knowledgeable as a modern gynecologist. Having gone through medical school, Cream surely had some understanding of human anatomy. However, this didn't necessarily equate to any surgical skill or practical knowledge. On top of this, his primary focus was abortion. In the 1800s, this was a highly taboo and dangerous procedure that hardly required skill, and one that left many women scarred and impaired. It usually involved the insertion of a sharp object or a blast of warm water into the birth canal to dislodge the fetus. Because of the widespread tissue damage these abortions created, precision wasn't necessarily critical in getting the job done. With this primitive approach, there may have been some 19th century abortionist who couldn't even say where the uterus was exactly. Although maybe Cream was exceptionally gifted, we can't say for sure. Even if he happened to be a well-rounded expert in female anatomy, it's not enough to point to his guilt.
However, one detail makes him a much more compelling suspect. Dr. Cream was a convicted serial killer. Several of Cream's patients died after his treatments, but for years, no one could prove he was responsible. Nevertheless, rumors ran wild. Eventually, when Ontario grew too hot, Dr. Cream relocated to Chicago. There, the doctor began an affair with a married woman, then fatally poisoned her husband in an insurance scam. Cream was caught, arrested, and sentenced to life in prison. But in a surprise turn of events, he received a term reduction and parole. 10 years after his conviction, he returned to the streets. Cream also returned to poisoning his patients, many of whom were sex workers. As for the sudden stop in murders, Cream was arrested in the summer of 1892, about 4 years after the Ripper killed his final canonical victim. This time, the courts found Cream guilty of 4 more murders and 1 attempted homicide. On November 15th, 1892, Cream was executed for his crimes. In a final chilling rumor, just before the hangman pulled the lever, he heard Cream say, "I am Jack." There may have been more to that statement, but we'll never know. Before Cream could finish speaking, the trapdoor boomed open and he fell to his death. It's easy to make this an open and shut case if we choose to entertain the similarities. Rumors of an unknown serial killer followed wherever Cream went, in part because Cream himself wrote taunting letters, much like Jack the Ripper. Years later, a handwriting expert found uncanny similarities. And as a 38-year-old 5'9" white man with a dark moustache, Cream matched the physical descriptions of the Ripper. Then there's the alleged confession. But we still have to consider that Cream's supposed last words weren't that he was Jack the Ripper. Maybe his statement was a reference to some other Jack. Or perhaps he was falsely taking credit for the Whitechapel murders to seize posthumous fame. After all, a basic look at their confirmed crimes reveals that Cream and the Ripper had far different MOs. While Cream poisoned his own patients, Jack seemed to attack at random, slashing women on the street. And then there's the wrinkle in the timeline. During the summer and fall of 1888, when the Ripper terrorized London's Whitechapel neighborhood, Dr. Cream was roughly 4,000 miles away in a Joliet, Illinois prison. His life sentence for his first murder conviction completely overlapped with the Ripper's autumn of terror. He didn't officially get out until 1891, 3 years after the final canonical death. Though some suspect he bribed a guard to let him go early or convinced a lookalike to serve his sentence while Cream walked free. This wasn't uncommon for the Illinois State Penitentiary. Allegedly, the facility was embroiled in multiple scandals during the late 19th century after various prisoners bought their release. Cream was never named in any of those cases, but he could have slipped through the cracks. After all, that's exactly what Jack the Ripper did, leaving us with several other valid suspects. In 1988, true crime investigators tied the Ripper to would-be physician Francis Thompson. The son of a doctor, Thompson enrolled in med school in 1877, but dropped out after 6 years to pursue creative writing in London. He moved in 1885, just 3 years before the Ripper's crime spree. But matters quickly turned south. Within 2 years, in the winter of 1887, Thompson was unhoused and addicted to laudanum.
Laudanum is a habit-forming opium tincture, and in the 1800s, laudanum addiction ran rampant throughout the Western world. Like other opiates, laudanum slows respiration and heart rate and induces feelings of euphoria. Regular use creates a physical neurochemical dependence, and with this comes impaired judgment, compromised decision-making, and of course, the inevitable withdrawal symptoms. All of this can create erratic behavior that could potentially result in violence. Thompson's drug use surely affected his behavior.
Thompson became romantically involved with a sex worker around this time. While her name has been lost to history, for simplicity, we'll call her Rhoda. For about a year, from 1887 to 1888, Rhoda let Thompson live with her while she provided food, emotional support, and cash. Instead of working in the medical field, Thompson pursued a writing career full-time with an annual salary of null. One day in April 1888, Rhoda left their shared apartment without explanation and never returned. Understandably, Thompson may have felt angry. Perhaps he was even insulted that a woman with so little social standing had rejected him, a doctor's son and blossoming poet. If he had grown bitter, against sex workers in particular, it's possible he decided to take out his frustrations in 1888. The poems he wrote at the time depict a man who prowled the nighttime streets, slashing women's stomachs until blood and fat poured out. Though Victorian literature is notoriously dark, this feels darker than the typical poet in the throes of a painful breakup. He may have been penning a confession. And as far as the timeline goes, in November 1888, Thompson finally sought help for his laudanum addiction, enrolling in a rehab program. Incidentally, this was right after the Ripper's final canonical kill. Maybe Jack stopped murdering because he overcame his addiction and developed healthier ways to cope with his feelings. But beyond the circumstantial, there's nothing definitive that links Thompson to Jack. Even his murderous poetry doesn't prove anything concrete. Plenty of heartbroken people create angsty art, and that doesn't make them killers. We can't even confirm his relationship with Rhoda led him to hating sex workers, so while the possibility is intriguing, it isn't airtight. This is the fundamental problem with many Jack the Ripper theories. In the century and a half since his murder streak, we've lost evidence, witnesses have died, and rumor and fact have hopelessly blended. It's nearly impossible to say exactly what's true. At best, sleuths can only guess at suspects' possible motives and methods. But in 2007, an author and a biochemist decided to take a new approach to the mystery. They partnered to solve the Ripper killings using a tactic that had never been considered before. Coming up, researchers isolate potential Ripper DNA. Now, back to the story. Throughout the 20th century, countless amateur sleuths tried to solve the Jack the Ripper murders, but nobody managed to produce a smoking gun. And the more time that passed, the more it seemed the Ripper might never emerge from behind the veil of secrecy. By the 21st century, if anyone wanted to make a compelling argument about the Ripper's true identity, they'd need to approach the case from an entirely new angle. And in 2007, an author named Russell Edwards got an idea in an unusual place. An auction. One of the items for purchase? A century-old silk shawl. Sold up front. Reportedly, the garment once belonged to Kate Eddowes, the Ripper's fourth canonical victim, whose murder produced a hard timeline for authorities. However, Kate's crime scene might have held another important lead. The night she died, Kate was wearing a shawl. Police officers found it on the ground, not far from her body. Allegedly, one of them brought it home, unwashed, as a gift for his wife. Horrified by the present, she refused to wear it or clean it. So the article of clothing remained in the officer's possession, then passed to his descendants when he died. Eventually, it was sold to an antique dealer, and in the early 2000s, it was once again put up for sale, bringing it to the curious attention of Russell Edwards. There was no way he could pass up the item. If this really was Kate's garment, it was a major piece of true crime history. Even better, there were claims that the cloth contained flecks of blood. In 1888, it wouldn't have meant much to police. But in the 21st century, the leftover human residue held promise. Once the shawl was in Edward's possession, he passed it along to Jari Lohelainen, a biochemist in Liverpool. Lohelainen was able to link some of the blood to a woman named Karen Miller, a descendant from Kate Eddowes' family. But some samples didn't match, suggesting the blood didn't come from Kate, but her killer. And that wasn't the only breakthrough. When Lohelainen shined a special light on the shawl, the fabric's reaction suggested it had semen on it. So he and Edwards ordered a DNA test to examine the fluid's mitochondrial DNA.
The term mitochondrial DNA, or mtDNA, refers to genetic information that's typically passed on from mothers to their children. For forensic purposes, it can be recovered from things like teeth, hair strands, bone, and semen. As opposed to other forms of DNA, mitochondrial DNA has unique benefits that investigators can take advantage of. For example, mtDNA has a much slower rate of degradation and a very high cellular copy capacity, which allows for a much greater preserved, available, and intact genetic visualization. In other words, a clearer and more detailed picture. Our mitochondrial DNA evolves and changes very little over time, and because it's inherited from our parents, it's very useful in tracing someone's genealogy. This could be a huge step in tracing the Ripper's roots and ultimately in identifying him. Mitochondrial DNA can be a huge benefit during a crime scene analysis.
Edwards and Lohelainen were excited to test the shawl against samples from the living descendants of several Ripper suspects who volunteered to have their DNA tested. Of course, to protect the volunteers' privacy, the researchers kept their genetic information secret. But they did announce a possible culprit once they found a match. A man named Aaron Kosminski. Kosminski first fell under suspicion in 1894 when an amateur sleuth noted that he lived and worked near the sites of the Ripper murders. Additionally, he may have been a tanner or cobbler, both of whom wore leather aprons. Kosminski also had a history of mental health conditions and was committed to a facility in 1890. Right around the time, the Ripper killings stopped. But even if the circumstantial fact corroborated hard science, Edwards and Lohelainen's findings brought in their own flurry of concerns. Since the science around mitochondrial DNA is still relatively new, and mtDNA isn't like a fingerprint or a full genome, people can share certain markers without being related to one another. There are only so many possible combinations of genes. So even though the semen on the scarf and Kosminski's descendants share the same mtDNA variants, the Ripper might not have had anything to do with Kosminski. Then there's the fact that no physical evidence ever suggested Jack sexually assaulted his victims. So if there was semen on that scarf, it may not have come from the killer. And after examining the garment, some experts concluded the semen wasn't even old enough to be from Edo's crime scene. Sadly, this whole story may be an elaborate hoax. So, like every other theory we've discussed, we end up in the same place. The evidence is intriguing, but it's still not open and shut. Looking at the residents of Whitechapel in 1888, there are so many suspicious figures, and we haven't yet considered half of them. For much of this investigation, we've been operating under the same premise as the Whitechapel police, that Jack the Ripper was a man with some medical training. But Jack the Ripper might not have been a Jack at all. While there were a small number of female doctors in the late 1800s, physicians aren't the only people with anatomical knowledge. Take midwives.
Women in the business of childbirth have a knowledge of anatomy, and some have specialized training. Typically, they offer assistance to obstetricians and gynecologists during uncomplicated births, and also help facilitate the care of new or expecting parents throughout the pregnancy. Depending on their qualifications, some midwives can give pelvic exams, pap tests, and run screenings for sexually transmitted infections. Even though their education is different from that of a doctor's and they lack surgical training, midwives do understand female anatomy, especially around the lower abdomen and pelvis, where Jack the Ripper most severely mutilated his victims.
And a midwife would have been able to hide in plain sight. In the 1800s, no one would have questioned a midwife kneeling over a bleeding woman. Midwives mostly worked on house calls, and after their work was done, they often wandered through East London at all hours of the night with bloodied clothing from attending childbirths. So a murderous midwife could slash her victim, then walk home with gore on her skirts, with no one any the wiser. The only problem with a female Jack is that eyewitnesses only ever saw the victims with a moustached man. Even then, it's possible she cross-dressed. Unfortunately, this theory wasn't really considered in the 1880s, so there aren't specific midwife suspects. If the Ripper was a woman dressed as a man, the disguise worked. Though, perhaps, the Ripper's disguise wasn't a gender, but a job. The other explanation for the Ripper's precise cuts beyond medicine is that Jack was a butcher or a slaughterhouse worker. Like physicians, employees in the meat industry know how to recognize organs. They have a lot of experience cutting them out of carcasses. They even know how to kill quickly and efficiently. Whitechapel in 1888 was filled with slaughterhouses and with laborers who spent their days and nights processing livestock. These workers, who rarely made enough money to buy meat for themselves, sometimes took unused organs from work to feed their families. So maybe this isn't a case with a medical killer, but it's still one that could be solved with medical science. Forensic medical historian Catherine D. Watson and professor of animal welfare and ethics Andrew Knight wrote a paper addressing the topic. They found it especially notable that Jack claimed he ate part of Kate Edo's kidney. According to them, if Jack saw his victims as animals to be butchered, And if he was used to consuming the organs from work, devouring a human body part might feel almost natural to him. But even that's just a shot in the dark. It seems that even with modern technology, the truth about Jack the Ripper lives more than anything in the story of who he might be.
While it may be too late to press charges against Jack, the unsolved murders continue to fascinate the general public. The slaughterhouse laborer theory is an interesting one that I've never heard before, but it definitely seems to have a smart footing. In looking back at the individuals we've discussed, if I had to choose, I'd put my money on Dr. Cream. While a lot of the variables don't line up, it's not difficult to imagine poor record-keeping and immense penal corruption in the 1800s. Maybe Cream used these things to his advantage. While the mystery is surely more intriguing, it's amazing to think that nearly 150 years of scientific advancement hasn't cracked the truth about Jack.
Ultimately, without a smoking gun, we'll likely never know who exactly the Ripper was or what his motives were, even if history has brought along some compelling theories. At this point, the lore surrounding Jack the Ripper surpasses any amount of hard evidence police ever had, which may clue us in about the long-lasting nature of his story. The continued piecing together of a century and a half old tale reminds us just how powerful mystery can be. We try to make sense of the unknown because part of us hopes the answer is just around the corner, waiting for us in the back alley of a Victorian England that has long since been lost to time. Thanks for listening to Medical Murders, and thanks again to Dr. Kipper for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Alistair.
You can find all episodes of Medical Murders and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. We'll see you next time. Medical Murders is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Brendan Hawkins, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Nick Johnson, Trent Williamson, and Carly Madden. This episode of Medical Murders was written by Angela Jorgensen, edited by Lauren DeLille and Maggie Admire, fact-checked by Bennett Logan, researched by Chelsea Wood, and produced by Freddie Beckley. Medical Murders stars Dr. David Kipper and Alastair Murden.